views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio. We are going to be talking about white-collar crime today. White-collar crime is rampant all over. Corruption is rampant all over society. And we have seen some really high-profile cases over the last decade or two, probably longer than that. But lately, with big businesses and government, we've seen a lot. The pattern has been that the people in charge, the highest executives, the leaders, have not been prosecuted. They get away with these crimes. And worse, businesses pay fines that are less than what they made on the fraudulent scheme, which really angers a lot of people. But there are a group of white-collar criminals that are being prosecuted. And those are the low-hanging fruit that can be caught and prosecuted without complicated, long, drawn-out, very expensive, and high-profile court cases, meaning they're easy to prosecute. The result are that the white-collar criminals who are brought to justice end up being poster children for all the white-collar corruption that we see in society and that we're very angry about. It is hard to feel sorry for these folks because they are criminals. They did do the crime and they deserve to be prosecuted if they stole from people, committed fraud and things. But they take on all the society white criminal that we're thinking of with these large financial firms and large companies and what we see in the media. And they take all that on from a public perspective. But there's so much shame that goes on behind that. And people don't realize that their innocent families, their spouse and their children often lose everything they have. They lose their house, their jobs, of course, status and relationships in the community. And the entire family suffers. And up until now, there has been no help for these people. We just kind of shun them as society. But we are going to be talking with Reverend Jeffrey Grant, and he is the director of the Progressive Prison Project. And that's the first ministry in the United States created to provide confidential support and counseling to individuals, families, and organizations with white collar and other nonviolent incarceration issues. He's going to talk about what the issues are behind white-collar criminals. I mean, they have a hard time accepting the shame, and they have a hard time getting back into society because they lost everything. It's very hard for them to get a job after that. So he's going to come on and talk about that. The one interesting thing, well, there's probably many interesting things, but the one really interesting thing about Jeffrey Grant is he was a white-collar criminal. He is the first person who's ever been formally incarcerated for a white-collar crime who has served as the head of a major reentry agency. He's going to come on and talk about what his ministry does and also what he does for the family reentry program. So let's not waste any more time and let's get into our interview with Jeffrey Grant. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Of course. You are an interesting person. Let's dive right into this. You are the only person who has been incarcerated for a crime to be named head of a criminal justice nonprofit, which is a remarkable situation. So now you got to tell us, what crime did you commit and how did you get here?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm the only person incarcerated for a white-collar crime who's been appointed as the executive director of the criminal justice nonprofit. I think there are probably many other people who've been incarcerated for crimes, but not for white collar crimes. So that, let's start off with that. And I think that, you know, I'm really privileged. I'm one of the rare people who've gone to prison for white collar crime, who've come out, and a lot of my friends, colleagues, people we help are struggling, suffering. It's not many people who can even find jobs after prison. And some people who were lawyers and investment bankers and financial people, you know, they're driving cabs or they're working on trucks, and it's very hard to find a job as a felon. So I feel very grateful. And I also feel grateful to be a power of example that there's hope and there's life out there after prison. And if you kind of stay with it and work your plan, good things can happen. Certainly I didn't have any idea after I committed my crime 15 or 16 years ago, and then I went to prison from 2006 to 2007, I had no idea that 10 years later, my life would come back in such a rich and rewarding way, and I would be the executive director of a criminal justice agency. You know, it's the last thing in the world I would have imagined when I was in prison.
Well, I want to get into how you got there, but what does your organization do?
Well, we are, I'm involved in two organizations. The first, my day job, is as executive director of Family Reentry, which is a criminal justice nonprofit in Connecticut. And we have offices in three cities, in Bridgeport, New Haven, and Norwalk. And then we have satellite programs in five other cities. And we do everything from prevention, intervention, reentry groups and reentry programs. We do some programs in the prisons themselves. We do it with the offenders and their families and their children and their wives, or if it happens to be a female offender, their husbands. So that's really rich, and it's mostly an inner city project. That's a full-time job. And then my night job is as director of Progressive Prison Ministries, which is the first ministry in the country to support white-collar criminals and their families. And my wife, Lynn Springer, and I do that together, and we have some other people who help us. And we support the white-collar community. It's a very misunderstood community. People believe what they read in the papers about sensationalized headlines about thinking everybody's a Bernie Madoff. That's not true. I mean, the overwhelming majority of people who are arrested or convicted of white collar crimes are pretty much normal people, professionals who live down the street, who got caught up in some issues and problems in their lives out of desperation or drug abuse or mental illness, or just got in over their heads and they didn't know what to do. But they're not wealthy, and they're not the mighty have fallen type of people. But most of them, when they go to prison, their families are destitute and they're completely out of money. They're living in their houses until they get evicted from them, and they're on all kinds of forms of state aid. You know, the families are in ruin. So
there's a lot of shame.
Huge amount of shame.
And they're very embarrassed. And So what crime did you commit, and how did you get to this point? Because you have a lot of personal experience that really, I think, fuels your passion.
I do. I was a lawyer in Westchester County, New York, and I moved my offices up from Manhattan up to Westchester in 1991. And in 1992, I had a sports injury, and I got addicted to prescription painkillers. And look, I wasn't the saint my whole life. You know, I was a kind of a normal kid, teenager who experimented with things. But I got hooked on prescription painkillers in 1992. And for 10 years, I took them almost every day. I had a friend who was a doctor, and he prescribed to me, and I don't blame him for that. I probably manipulated him into it. But by the time 1999 or 2000 came along. I was deep into my addiction. And the day came when in my firm, in my law firm, we had 25 people working for me at that point. And the day came when we couldn't make payroll. And instead of doing a smart or reasonable thing, like call the bank or call a friend who could have lent me the money, I told my office manager to dip into the escrow funds. And we did. And that started my deal with the devil. And my life was never the same from that point on. I spent the next 2-3 years looking over my shoulder, being I was the subject of a ethics committee investigation. And during the course of that, 9/11 happened, and I got very overwhelmed by 9/11 because of all the things that were happening in my life. And because my office was in Westchester, and at that point we had probably lost half of our business, they were running ads on TV and radio for businesses that had been affected by 9/11. And I called them up and I told them my situation. And they told me I qualified. So I put in an application and I got an SBA 9/11 loan for a little under $250,000. And at the end of, I took the money, but it didn't help my law firm. And in July of 2002, I resigned my law license, and I took an overdose of the painkillers, and I tried to kill myself. And that really that was really the end of the first chapter of my life.
You know, I think that people don't realize how hard it is to be an entrepreneur in hard times in our country and all the things that go into it, or in any kind of high profile, lots of responsibility type job. You know, a lot of people can get into, you're just so desperate. You're on the front lines trying to do things. But keep going. I don't want to cut you off. It started a avalanche for you, didn't it?
Yeah, I just want to respond to the entrepreneur comment that you made, and I think you're exactly right. I think one of the issues of being an entrepreneur is that in a way you have to be kind of a maverick. You have to most entrepreneurs are kind of doing it alone, or they're doing it with a very small budget. They don't really usually have around them a lot of people who can they can trust. Like a board of directors. And so they can wind up with big problems that are kind of caused by kind of a go-go attitude, trying to get it all done and not really watch themselves in terms of compliance, or they take risks that they might not otherwise take if they had the access to good resources. And that was probably the case with me as well. But to continue the story, you know, I had embellished that SBA loan that I applied for, and told the SBA when I before I got approved that I had an office in Lower Manhattan near 9/11. I'm not sure, quite sure why I did that, since I was told I would have the I would have been approved for the loan anyway.
So would that have gotten you more money?
I still don't understand.
Would you have gotten more money?
No.
So
no.
Then why did they go after you when you would have been approved anyways and the same money? And just because, it's not good that you did that, but same standpoint, the whole thing is kind of weird.
Well, I would have been approved with an office in Westchester, but then I lied on the application and said I had an office in Manhattan. And it was the lying on the application, which was the thing that caused the federal government to look at me and determine that I had been guilty of a felony. And they were right. I did. I had intentionally misled them. And there was probably no good reason for it other than the fact that I was desperate. And I just did it. And I have no explanation. But I got clean and sober from the painkillers in 2002. And when I was about 20 months sober in 2004, I got a call from the FBI, and they told me that there was a warrant out for my arrest in connection with that loan that I had made the fraudulent representations on. And I had to go down to Lower Manhattan, to Pearl Street, to the federal courthouse, and get arrested and get arraigned. And for the next 2 years, until 2006, I pretty much sat around waiting to get sentenced. I got sentenced in 2006, early 2006, to 18 months in federal prison. I reported in April of 2006 to Allen Woodlow Security, a correctional institution in White Deer, Pennsylvania, where I served 13 and a half months. I came out of prison, did a halfway house and house arrest, and then served 3 years of federal supervised release with a probation officer here in Connecticut, and started a new life, you know, and not an easy one. Like, it's
because nobody wants to hire a felon
convicted of a crime,
right? Nobody wants to hire a felon of into another type of educated type management type position where you have responsibility.
I think that's true. That's true. I'd like to think it's changing a little bit now. At the time I went through all of this, certainly when it started, it wasn't like mass incarceration and related issues, white collar crime. They weren't really the subject of a lot of conversation. They weren't in the headlines at that point. There weren't a lot of people who had gone to jail for white collar crimes and come out who could be helpful to one another. I was definitely alone, and my family was alone in trying to deal with it. It's not so much the case anymore, and that's one of the reasons we started our ministry for white collar criminals.
There was no help for people.
Prison,
there was no help for people. Okay, what happened when you came out of prison?
So when I came out of prison, I had to have court. I had court mandated drug and alcohol counseling, and my counselor said to me, I mean, I told him that I'd been going to recovery and I'd been sober at that point for 5 years. And he said to me, well, that's great, you know, but you can't put any of that on a resume. So what I'd like you to do is start doing things that are helpful for your resume and helpful to the world. And we agreed that would be through some kind of volunteerism. So I started on the road to volunteerism, and I volunteered for the rehab that I had gone to when I was recovering from drugs and alcohol. And then I went to some various other nonprofits until I started volunteering at Family Reentry, which is the nonprofit that I'm currently executive director of. But in 2009, I was a volunteer there, and they asked me to be on their board of directors, which I was. I accepted the position. The same year, I got the calling to do this kind of work, you know, prison ministry work in a more faithful way. And I applied to Union Theological Seminary in Manhattan. And when I was very, very nervous when I made the application, because I'd never told my whole story to anybody. But I had to be completely truthful in my application and in my essay, tell them what I had done and my history of drug addiction and alcoholism and white collar crime. So I attended Union Theological Seminary for the next 3 years and graduated there with a Master of Divinity in 2012 with a focus in Christian social ethics. And my first job after seminary was as the associate pastor and director of prison ministries at the First Baptist Church in Bridgeport, which was a church in the hood. And so my wife and I were living in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest towns in the country. And we were working in one of the most depressed cities in the country, which is Bridgeport. And we were living this kind of bifurcated life. I mean, we weren't living lavishly, but we were in a little apartment by the near the railroad station in Greenwich. And we were working in Bridgeport because at that point, Lynn was helping up in the church and helping with some of the prison ministry. And I got a phone call from a reporter at a hedge fund magazine who asked me if I was the guy who was living in Greenwich and helping hedge fund guys in Greenwich through recovery, helping them deal with their prison issues. So was I the minister to hedge funders? And I said, well, I help guys in Greenwich because I live there and I go to recovery there, but I minister in Bridgeport where they have different kind of issues. And he said to me, well, you know, maybe you should think about combining those efforts. And as soon as he said that, kind of a light bulb went off in me, and I went to in my head, and I went to my wife, and I said, "You know, I think our unique proposition has come in. I think that there's a whole constituency of people who have committed white collar crimes, and their families who have been victimized by this, and they're not being able to get reenter into society. And I think that we can start a ministry for these white collar families." And we set out to try to do that. We went to churches in Greenwich, and we went on the conference circuit, and we did sermons all over the Eastern Seaboard. And the more we spoke about it, more people came out of the woodwork. You know, they were suffering in silence in their homes and living behind closed blinds and shunned and stigmatized. And other families wouldn't let their children play with them anymore, and they were thrown out of their clubs, and some of them were even thrown out of their houses of worship. And we gave them a voice. We gave them permission to be able to speak and come out. And so in a way, it's kind of been like an avalanche of people who were formerly suffering in silence, you know, in isolation. But now we have this robust white collar ministry where we minister thus far to people in 25 different states. And we hold an online support group every Tuesday night on a video conference. And people call in from all over the country and share about their lives and their successes and their tragedies and trying to overcome this these huge obstacles in life. And it's the greatest thing that I've ever done. It gives me a sense of purpose. And we were running this white collar ministry. We've been doing it now for 3 or 4 years, and with a lot of magazine articles and a lot of interviews. And these people are very curious about white collar crime and what it is to actually be on the front lines of trying to create more empathy and compassion and less stigma and shunning. When Family Reentry tapped on my shoulder because they needed a new executive director, and they asked me if I would do that. And of course I said yes, because one, I believe in the mission, and I believe in helping all people who are going through incarceration issues. But also I knew that I would be the first person in the country who'd been incarcerated for white collar crime to be appointed as the executive director of a criminal justice nonprofit. And I wanted to be a power of example. I wanted to show other people going through these issues that it can be done. And so, you know, we're very, very, we're proud of this. We're happy about it. We take it seriously. We do it with humility, because we know that, you know, we were chosen, and this is something that we have to do right. You know, we have to live exemplary lives. When you're a white collar criminal, you don't really have the opportunity to make so many mistakes anymore.
So, well, yeah, you're under a microscope.
Thoughtfully.
Well, I got.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I have a question. Do you think that the current state of our country, where there's high profile banks and other institutions, they're doing major crimes that are going, that they're not being prosecuted for? There's a lot of examples of a lot of things that have been done and no one has gone to prison. Do you think that the white collar criminals who are getting nailed for things, and they're more for smaller stuff, let's admit that what you did is pretty little compared to some of these crimes that are going on. Do you think the people's anger and everything is going towards these smaller white collar criminals because the big fish aren't getting taken down? And so the culture is just this big wrath upon the small white collar criminals.
I don't think so. I think that the reason why, say, insider trading was such a perfect target for the U.S. Attorney's Office is because it's the low-hanging fruit. It's easy to prosecute. It's one person or a small group of people who've done something that they can isolate and they can actually prosecute.
Yeah, it makes it look like they're doing something.
Yeah, well, I think that to the extent that laws have been broken, they should be enforced. I think the sentencing is completely out of whack, and I think that the mandatory minimums should be completely changed, and the sentencing guidelines should be changed. And I do think it's unfair that certain people who've committed crimes are targeted when their behavior is very similar to entire classes of people who aren't being prosecuted. But I understand it.
We can't feel sorry for you because you still committed a crime. But the same standpoint, this isn't. It doesn't take away from the fact that there are bigger fish out there who are doing bigger crimes that really need to be taken down. I mean, I don't know. And do you think that also with all these big crimes going on, do you think that there is a tendency for the average person to say, well, if they can do it and nothing happens to them, then I'm going to do it? You know, our leaders are showing that you can get away with crime. So why not me do it?
You know, I hope that's not the case. I mean, it probably is the case. But the people that we deal with are people who've in large part actually committed crimes and are paying for them. There's no value really in either denying a crime that you've committed or looking at someone else who might be sitting at the next desk in a large trading room or something, looking at next desk and saying, hey, he's doing the same thing I did. Why didn't he get prosecuted? Because the truth is that, you know, once you're in the midst of it, the sooner you just take responsibility and figure out how to live a happy, productive life on the other side of these problems, the better. You know, there can be as many sour grapes as you'd like about what coulda, shoulda. But the truth is that living in acceptance and moving forward with some kind of, grace and elegance is important. Most people can't do it. And that's one of the reasons we've banded together and formed a ministry and a support group is so that people will live in this kind of radical acceptance. This is my life. I mean, the same is true, for example, of someone who gets hit by a car, who has cancer, has kidney problems. You know, how can you look at the next guy and say, well, you know, why did I have the kidney problems, but they didn't?
You have to admit
and
what
why am
you
I
did.
Under dialysis,
right?
Dialysis?
You have to admit what you did in order to heal and to be a better person. You can't shun the responsibility. You still have to take responsibility for your own, what you did. And so somebody in that place isn't the right person to be pointing fingers at what's going on. But, you know, from a leadership standpoint, I look at it and go, well, wait a minute here. Yeah, I think it's good that we're prosecuting these people. But I think we're also creating a culture that's saying, yes, this is okay to do these things and get away with it. And so then, you know, now we have this whole epidemic going on where we're nailing the small hanging fruit, but yet we set an example that this is an okay behavior. But I understand that for what you're doing, it's not a good frame of mind, because unless they get to the point where they say, yes, I did commit this and this is wrong and I got to take responsibility for what I am, it doesn't help them heal or get past it.
Yeah, I mean, take responsibility for what I've done, not what I am.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. All, sorry, wrong words. You know, all,
yeah, yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, and I also think that it's an opportunity. As you point out, there's a lot of injustice in the world, and a lot of people doing a lot of wrong things. There's a lot of people probably doing right things as well. But that's where we tell our stories to colleges and business schools and law schools and even high schools. Because it's a cautionary tale. What we'd like to have young people thinking about is, you know, what kind of risk do I really want to take in the world? What are my real values? I mean, do I value, love and family and community? I mean, for most of us, because of whatever our issues were, we put things before the things that we claim to care most about. I mean, there's no question that I was putting drugs and greed before my love of my family. It's not something I'm proud of, but it's something that if I talk about openly, that not only is it a healing process for me and a healing process for my family, but also what I can hopefully move the needle a little bit in terms of people's awareness of what's going on. And if it only means a few people even are going to think twice before they step over the line and do something, wrong or something criminal, then I think I've done my job.
Yeah, that's excellent. Because just teaching people ethics and basic morality. Well, we have a prison problem in this country. And I read an article that you just wrote on Martin Luther King Day. And we have a mass incarceration, right? We have more people in prison. The Jim Crow, what was it that you were saying about we have more people in prison, black men in prison than we did during men that we had in slavery?
There are actually more black male adults in prison right now than there were slaves pre-Civil War.
What do you think? Why is that happening?
Well, I think that, you know, the new Jim, as Michelle Alexander points out, in the new Jim Crow, that it's all about money. It's about making money on people. And it's always been that way in one way or another. There's a slave culture, and people who are in power can make money either directly on their work product, and that was true in slavery, or now when we have the prison industrial complex, where huge amounts of money are made in putting people in captivity because the governments will pay for them and they'll tax the people, to the point where we have a prison ecosystem, a monetized ecosystem that probably is in the neighborhood of $150 billion a year, which, just to give you some sense about the size of that, that's probably twice the size of Nike. And it puts money on a lot of people's tables, puts the food on a lot of people's tables and makes them a lot of money. But they're doing it on the backs of other people.
Of our communities and our schools and all sorts of things.
And on people who are unfairly arrested, unfairly tried, who don't have access to good counsel, who don't have never had a good start to begin with. They didn't have two parent homes. They didn't have access to good education, good health care. They grew up on the streets, gang cultures, things like that. I mean, it's an atrocity of our times and of this country that we actually allow this kind of thing to exist. So it's not surprising when we see that there is, these police shootings or all kinds of other things that are going on, because, you know, we've created it in this country, and we can do better, and we can do better by really putting people first and really creating a dignity and respect in our inner cities. And to do that, we have to put resources into that. It means what we have to put money into our inner cities. You know, we have to create, instead of a second chance society, we really have to create a first chance society. And we have to give these people and these communities a first chance, one that they've never been given before. So look, I'm all in favor of giving someone a chance when they come back from prison. And I think that's important, but they had no first chance to begin with, most of them. So it's a shame.
Well, public defenders have 500 cases on average a year. So what I understand is a lot of times the first time they ever meet the person that they're defending or even look at their case is right before they go into court with them or right before they're, you know, supposed to go to court. And so what they're doing is doing pleas because they know they can't defend them. So they're automatically doing a plea deal, and these kids who might be completely innocent or might be just riding in the car with their older brother, next thing you know, they're in prison for 3 years, and we just destroyed their life because now we got them sucked into that system. And I just think there's some basic things we can do, like give them public defender, get them a real defense, and if they're innocent, don't put them in prison. And if they're a young teenage kid who's 16, so just because they're in the car with their older brother, give them a different, you know, steer them a different way so that we can take these beautiful kids and let them have a life.
Look, you're absolutely right. That's an atrocity. But even for people who can afford counsel, there's the overwhelming majority of cases, a huge amount, 95, 99%, are still resolved by plea bargains, because nobody can really afford, or very few can really afford, to go up against the government. And the penalty for defending yourself could be a sentence that's 10 times the amount that you'd be given under the plea. So that's quite a risk to be advocating or defending yourself against a prosecutorial tsunami of resources, and almost nobody can afford it. Even well-to-do people can't afford it. It destroys their households. It destroys. It can take every penny they have. So in some ways, we're part of the same problem. Of course, it's probably more acute in the inner city where they're rounding up people, and with the school to prison pipeline, we're actually creating a culture of incarceration, and there's almost no opportunity for defense. So I think you're right. I think there's no quick fix for it, other than all of us, committing ourselves to making the community a better place and more supportive place, and changing that culture. And I think it's happening in pockets. I think that some nonprofits are committed to doing that. We're certainly committed to doing that at Family Reentry in Bridgeport and New Haven and Norwalk. I mean, that's the reason we exist, to strengthen the community and help families avoid prison and avoid criminal justice issues. I mean, we don't want to just be in the business of rehabilitating people who've been in prison. I mean, that's a noble task, but we would love to be able to dig deep and change things even before it happens.
I have somebody that I want to hook you up with, which is Mike Tikkanen, and he works very hard on the young ones, keeping them out of the family welfare system and all the abuses, because their concept is that once they get into that system, it's 7 years to the to the prison system, and it's almost a direct route, and the percentages are extremely high of those kids going directly into the prison system, because the youth system is not serving them either. So he is a great resource for you, I think. But I'm disappointed in this, because we're the only country in the world with this issue. And so it's a cultural issue that doesn't need to be there. This phenomena, it's something that is unique to the United States, and it's very traumatic to our neighborhoods. And if our leadership in the communities, in the politics, in the businesses, if our leadership altogether said, wait a minute, we got to get our act together, and we need to be more mindful of what's going on in our communities, and we need to lead. Leading doesn't mean just let's all make as much money as possible. We need to be true leaders and do what's right for the people of our communities and get off our butts and really make a difference and be more holistic in the way we look at this. Because when you look at other countries, they don't have, they have problems, but they don't have these level of problems. So there's no excuse. We can't say that we are a country of excellence with this kind of problem at our feet. So if other countries can do it, we can do it, and let's get off our butt and do it. And so that's where I'm at. I'm just like, hello, let's fix this. So I'm so happy that there's people like you that said, hello, I'm going to fix this, and I'm going to do what I can and educate people, because I don't see a greater problem in our lifetime than this right now. I really don't. When you have percentages of like 45% of our children being abused and being, funneled into these kind of situations, I don't understand what's a bigger problem than this. But go ahead.
Look, I agree with you. And one thing that criminal justice experts can agree upon is that prison itself, incarceration itself, the only reason it's a problem is because of the scale of it. Because we have 2.3 million people in prison or in jails in this country, and 10 million of them come through the system every year. And that 90 million people in this country a full quarter of the of our population in the country have criminal records. And it's only because of the scale that it's really a problem, because in most countries, the criminal justice system is not the problem itself. It's a symptom of the problem, because the problems themselves are poverty, racial injustice, poor education, poor health care, all the things that become the factors in leading someone into the criminal justice system. So if we went back to where we were in the 1970s and we were only incarcerating, say, 300,000 people per year, which is less than 1% of the U.S. population, we wouldn't really be considering criminal justice itself as a problem, but it's a symptom of problems. But because it's grown to be so large and so much of a moneymaker, it's become a problem unto itself. So that's really the distinguishing factor between what's going on in the United States and in other countries, is that we've actually, it's a man-made problem. We've actually created this problem out of nothing so that it can benefit some at the expense of others.
Well, I think we should be embarrassed.
What politics is.
Well, yes, but I think we should be embarrassed because it shows a collapse of our communities and social standards. And any leader that can see the big picture should be able to look at this and go, oh my gosh, we are failing our communities and our families and what is right and what is just and what is ethical. And we need to do better than this. We deserve better. Everyone needs to do better, because there isn't anything more important than our community. I mean, why do we exist other than for our families and our communities, right? I don't even know what's more important than that.
Agreed. And I think that it's very easy to see, except that it may not serve, you know, politicians' purposes or big businesses' purposes, but it's easy to see that if we're, for example, in the state of Connecticut, we spend in excess of $600 million a year on the prison system. And if we reduce the prison population by 10%, and say so that means we save $60 million off of the prison budget, it would make sense to reinvest 10% of that, say $6 million into community-based services to be able to help people when they come back from prison and to help the communities themselves so that people never go to prison. And so a 10-to-1 ratio of not spending the $60 million and reinvesting the $6 million is what makes sense. It's called justice reinvestment. The problem is that the legislatures, who are under a lot of pressure right now to save money, because a lot of states, budgets are killing them. So they're under a lot of pressure to save the $60 million. But what they don't want to do is really spend any more money. So they won't even spend the $6 million. So people are coming out of prison, and they're coming out in the tens of thousands across the country right now. And prison populations are, by and large, they are reducing. But these people come out onto the street and they come into the community and they have no behavioral services. They have no wraparound services. They have no access to jobs. They have no substance abuse and behavioral services that are mandated by the state under the terms of their parole. And it's just it's a powder keg. It's just a matter of time until they recidivate and go back to prison, or something dramatic happens where some people would be hurt that wouldn't otherwise have been hurt. And then the whole culture changes. Everyone's attitude about criminal justice reform changes because, oh my God, what we've done is we've let criminals out of prison, when it's our fault to begin with, because what we haven't done is provide them the adequate services for them to succeed.
Well, are they doing it mindlessly? Because how can they do things that are so dumb, for lack of a better word? It's just so dumb. I mean, how can they do that? What are people supposed to do when they come out of prison and they don't have a way to work? They have no means of getting a job and no support structure for that. They've lost that support structure. I mean, how are they going to survive without going back to the only thing they know? I think we have to at least get them a pathway into providing their own sense of living and sense of respect for themselves.
That's right. Most people, most of them will go back to what they know. And that's that same kind of criminal thinking that got them to trouble to begin with. And if they're drug dealers, for example, they're going to go back to being drug dealers. And who wouldn't if you can't get a job and you can't get a house and you can't get access to substance abuse treatment? Who wouldn't do that? You got they go on survival mode and they do what they know how to do. Yeah.
And from one standpoint, I can see, why should I spend money on these guys? Let them, they need to get their act together. They need to get it done. Okay, they do. And I agree with you. But at the end of the day, it's just going to cost us more money. Our communities are going to be hurt more, and we're going to pay more money to keep them in jail. So if we spend a little bit of money and make sure that they get jobs and they can support themselves, then we are helping ourselves. You know, our communities will be safer, and they will have more respect. And so, yeah, I agree. They need to just get it done and do it. But that's not the reality of it. And so we have to be smarter.
Yeah, we have to be smarter. We have to take the lessons we learned from some of our other criminal justice systems around the world who've solved some of these problems differently than the way we have, and with much greater success. And, you know, the thing that you always have to look at in criminal justice systems, you have to look at risk factors, and you have to look at, health factors for the ecosystem, what's actually creating wellness. And I think that once you understand that 95% of the people who go to prison will be coming home to the community. So only 5% of the people will remain in prison for either for life or until they pass away in prison. So 95% will come back. So the question is, what do you want those 95% to look like? What do you want them to be? What do you want them? How healthy do you want them to be? I know if it's for me and there's 2.3 million people in prison in this country, and over 2 million of them are going to come back into the regular world, I'd like to believe that they're not going to hurt us, or they're not going to do other things that are aberrational to what we believe is a healthy society, because they have to survive. It would be makes much more sense to make sure to give them the best shot they can to be able to get jobs and work, get educations and housing. But, we need a people's movement, apparently, in order for that to happen, because the legislatures are not doing it so much.
Yeah, it's just not a priority. So if you had a magic wand and you had the ability to make some changes, what solutions would you put in place that would really make a big impact into this problem, long term, not short term, but really make a change and make a difference for our communities and for our businesses, because they'd have more educated workforce, that everything would be better.
I'm not sure that there's any one big idea out there that would carry the day.
Even small solutions.
But I think that countries that have created cultures of character, whether it be young people, say 18, 19 years old, who somehow have compulsory service into the military or Peace Corps or AmeriCorps, or they have to actually do some kind of service, it would probably change our entire, in one generation, it would probably change our entire culture of who we are. It would lift people up out of poverty. It would train them. It would create character. It would give them access to college funds. If when they got out, they would have qualify for low interest loans. I mean, this is something that could happen. But there's a big idea. I don't know that it could actually gain traction, and I don't know that would really be understood, but certainly there are big ideas out there, and that's one of them.
Well, I can just tell you right now, I'd like to fund the fact that prosecutors, public defenders, that they actually get a defender, and that we look honestly at whether we should be putting these people in prison or not. So that if we're putting 99% of these people, we plea them and book them or whatever they say, we got to relook at that and say, okay, what is the realistic percentage that should be going in prison? And say, okay, maybe 45% or something. We need to say, okay, these 55, we got to get better and say, okay, we need to give these proper defense. These prosecutors aren't going to be looked at as just, let's see how many people we can nail. And it's more like we get another stripe on our badge because we nail as many people as we can. No, they're looked at differently, and they're putting people in prison based on who really should be going to prison. So it's more of a team-based approach. Who should be going to prison based on who really did something wrong? Nobody can afford a defense anyways. So let's really look at this from a team-based approach with the public defender, the prosecutor, the judge, and look at it for real. Not just, let's see how many people we can nail because I'm winning another touchdown. Got to get rid of that mentality and then start looking at doing some good things with our children when they're young. Stop the abuse, the cycles of abuse in our neighborhoods. So we also do the same thing at the children welfare systems. We make sure that the children who need mental health services aren't put into these schools, and these teachers who have zero mental health training are getting bombarded by all these kids who need mental health services instead of teaching. So we allow these teachers to go back to teaching, and we put mental health people in to deal with these kids. I mean, there's just some real common sense we can put in place that long term would completely change us around. And we would save so much tax money. It would be absolutely incredible. More people would thrive. We'd stabilize our country, and we'd have a stronger foundation for our businesses and for everything, which we need going into the future. So that's my two cents.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you're passionate about it. I mean, I think that's huge. And there's not enough people that speak up. I mean, this is dinner table conversation, and progressives or liberals probably discussing this over dinner all the time.
Well, but I think everybody should. It's like, I'm an independent. I don't know if I consider myself progressive or conservative. I think this is a common sense approach to what our communities need. And in a lot of ways, I tend to be more libertarian in some ways. But we're in such a panic mess that we're not taking care of our basic needs as a community.
I agree with you. And for a while, we thought we were going to have some wide-based federal criminal justice reform. In fact, we still might. And both sides of the aisle seem to agree on a lot of major points, including a revision of mandatory minimums and sentencing guidelines and things like that. But, you know, it stalled up on the federal level, and there's a certain trickle-down effect for all of that. I have suspicions as to why that happened in terms of the politics of it. But, you know, I'm hoping at least one of the things that will happen as a result of the administration change in Washington, without getting into any wider politics, is I'm hoping it means that criminal justice reform is going to be put back on the table. And I hope that's not going to be kind of warped or abused or bended like a pretzel into anyone's particular agenda, but it will really be about fairness. I hope. But we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, I hope, because there's a bigger problem. See, I cover all these issues, and I was kind of clueless a little bit when I first started on these issues, because I'm more business approach. I teach at the Carlson Business School at the University of Minnesota, and I teach ethics and leadership and entrepreneurship and things. And so I started, you know, I've gotten asked to cover some of these issues, so I cover and talk. Next thing you know, I'm learning about all these things, and to me, it's an avalanche of, well, this is kind of obvious. This is hurting our communities and our business environment. And, you know, CEOs are complaining and about not having a workforce and all these. It's like, well, hello. This is so obvious to me.
Here's something you could do, Sarah. I don't know if it's appropriate, but we'd be happy to come out and speak at your school and start a real conversation about what it is to have ethics on the ground, not just ethical principles that you read about in books or that you study in case studies, but what is it when you're really faced with hardcore decisions and what goes into those decisions. And we can give you know, testimony, you know, testify as to what we did right or wrong in our lives. And we can bring some people out there to do it. And when we've done it, you know, the students, you know, most of them, they really want to live good, righteous lives. And no one's in college thinking that, okay, what I'm going to do is set out to be a criminal. You know, something happens along the way and they don't really know what that is. But on the other side of it, we do, you know, and we have a collective understanding of it because my wife and I, we've worked with probably, I don't know, hundreds of people who've convicted of white collar crimes or their families. And there are some commonalities between it. There are differences too, but I think it's a really robust conversation, something that we can really, we can move things forward, but we need people to host that, to say
sure,
that this is.
Yeah, we can definitely look at that. I know that there are, there's a big push at the business schools now to bring ethics into the business schools and have people be more mindful of what they're doing. Because a lot of times people are just implementing a process or they're getting sucked into the culture and they don't realize they're part of the problem. And so the goal is to make them more aware of what they're doing and what the consequences of what they're doing is and how it hurts people around them and their self long term. And it's, so it's becoming just much more aware of what you're doing and what your ethics really are and who you are as a person and applying that to what you're doing in the business world. Because after all, the businesses are there to support the communities and vice versa. And we need to, we want to live in a much better environment where more people can thrive. Because in the end, we'll be better off all around. More ideas. When you're in a more ethical environment, people feel better about themselves. More innovations occur, and we can move far. We can move farther along as a society. So there's a lot of benefits to the ethical, you know, path that we can take. But I appreciate you so much for joining us today. And it's, we're running out of time, and I want to definitely, we'll catch up after we get off this interview and figure out a way that we can keep in contact and maybe get you into doing some speaking. So I would appreciate that. And thank you so much.
Great. Let me just tell everyone how they can reach me.
Yes, absolutely.
It's Jeff Grant and I'm the executive director of Family Reentry. So my email is jeffgrant@familyreentry.org. And I can be reached there. You can look us up online at familyreentry.org or our white collar project at prisonist.org. We'd love to hear from you. Please get take a look at the articles we have online and the links. Try to be very, very helpful to everybody. We respond to every inquiry and we want to hear from you.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. And I'll hang on so we can speak after.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Jeffrey Grant. I want to remind you that all contact information for my guests are up on my website at sarahwestall.com, as well as articles that go with the episodes that I do and the interviews that I do. I also want to tell you that we are on many different channels. We play at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on WBLQ in New York, Rhode Island, and Connecticut. And we also play 3 p.m. on the Global Star National Satellite that airs all over the country and in Hawaii and Alaska. And we also play on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Global Star Satellite and 7 days a week on Transformation Talk Radio. And you will find us on over 100 different digital channels, as well as my YouTube channel that is really exploding. So don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel and also sign up for the newsletter that goes out about every week and a half, something like that. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. As Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.